As we start this morning, I want to start with a quote from John Adams in 1813, actually June 28, 1813, and I'm telling you this because you can go look the letter up. Go read the letter for yourself. He wrote to Thomas Jefferson, and he was recalling how it was for them during the Revolution. He said, remember when we all came together and how beautiful it was to see people from so many different groups coming together. He said, what united us all? What were we able to center around? This is part of the letter. He said the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. Now, a couple things worth noting. Not just he's highlighting Christianity as the thing they gathered around. Anytime you see an ellipse in a quote, it's always worth asking what's missing, right? Because we see professors these days that will take a quote and they will make it say the exact opposite of what it actually says. That's why we encourage people, go look at the original document. What I will point out is one of our biggest challenges is trying to condense a really powerful, strong quote to small enough text that we can put it on a slide on a screen to make it easier for people to see and read, but we're not doing justice to what's actually there. Because what he said was the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence, they were the principles upon which all of us could unite. They were not the principles of the Episcopalians alone, or the Methodists alone, and he goes through and lists all these denominations. He said instead they were the general principles of Christianity, but he talks about how all these people came together, and the reason, again, this kind of matters, John Adams was the guy, when he was asked, how did America come together, and I will... The next lecture, I'll get into this a little bit more, but John Adams said pastors are the ones largely responsible for motivating, stirring us into action, getting us involved. And the reason we can say that that was absolutely accurate, historically speaking, is because there's historians that have gone back and documented from the Declaration alone. And one great example is Alice Baldwin. She wrote a book called New England Clergy and the American Revolution. She was a professor from Duke University back in the early and mid-1900s. And back when people still had some intellectual integrity in the academic world, but she went through and documented that every single grievance identified in the Declaration of Independence had been preached from American pulpits prior to 1763, and she actually went through and listed the names of the sermons and the names of the pastors who delivered the sermon and what topic it was and where it was in the Declaration. So actually, John Adams is literally showing that or Alice Baldwin is, but what John Adams said where pastors are the ones largely responsible for the Revolution, Alice Baldwin shows that like literally the Declaration is nothing more than a listing of pastors' sermons. And we talked about this a little bit last night, but for many people, we have not grown up learning, and most people don't say this today, that the founding fathers were influenced by Christianity, but to think that we don't really know that or don't hear that very much today is only an indication that we know so little history today. Because if you go back, when did the founding fathers get together for the very first time? Well, there was actually a painting done of the very first time the founding fathers got together. The very first time they got together was in 1774. This is when they called for the first Continental Congress, and delegates from all the colonies, they came and got together. And when they got together, they decided, what's the best way for us to open what we're doing? Well, we should open with prayer. And it's actually super interesting to go back and even read some of the records, which I think we have a little booklet. There might still be one over there, I don't know, called America's Godly Heritage. We have the story in the Founders Bible. There's a few different places we have the story where it's documented from all these different letters and writings of the guys explaining what was there. But as it was there, people said, hey, maybe we should pray. And there were guys like Edward Rutledge and John Jay who said, I don't know if that's a good idea. Well, why not? They said, well, because we have Episcopalians in our midst. And us Congregationalists, we don't do stuff with Episcopalians. Okay? Early America, every colony was founded genuinely by people escaping religious persecution in Europe, coming to America seeking religious freedom. But when they got to America, everybody set up their own colonies. And in early America, of the 13 colonies, 9 of them had official state-established religions. 2 more of them had unofficial established religions, and they didn't play in the sandbox very well together. So, like the Quakers, right, that they were probably the most friendly, but then you had the Catholics and the Anglicans and the Episcopalians, and you had the Baptists and you had the Congregationalists, and they didn't like each other because when they came to America, right, some of, like, for example, the Congregationalists, they'd been persecuted by the Anglicans, right? They had been persecuted by the Catholics. So we come here, no, your people persecuted us. Well, some of the Anglicans or Catholics, they're like, well, we were persecuted, right? We came from Germany, and you had to be Lutheran. And if you weren't Lutheran, you couldn't be there. And so everybody had been persecuted. They came together. It was Sam Adams who said, you're all crazy. He said, I am no bigot. And as long as the individual who leads us in prayer believes in God and the Bible, it's probably going to be okay. Well, they end up having a prayer. The Reverend Jacob Duché, the guy in the middle, is the one who leads them in prayer. And it is fascinating to go back and read the writings of the guys who were there. Because like John Adams, he wrote his wife Abigail a letter. And this is, I'm saying this, these are all things that are very searchable on the internet. You can go find these letters. So this is, again, don't take my word for this. You can go look this up. But John Adams wrote Abigail, and he talked about what had happened. This is part of the letter he told her. He said, I must beg you to read that psalm. Read the 35th psalm to your friends. Read it to your father. Now, Psalm 35 is a psalm that most impressed him. Now, earlier in the letter, he talked about how they spent 2 hours in prayer and then 2 hours studying the Bible together. That's like a 4-hour church service, right? Most of us maybe remember like the old days of church when it went for like an hour and a half or 2 hours, right? Modern services, you're going for like an hour and we're like, hey, pastor, we got to go. Like 4 hours? This is crazy. This is the founding fathers. And this is how they start their meeting, is with 2 hours in prayer, 2 hours in Bible study. But there's a lot of providence involved in even some of the way it's unfolded. But John Adams tells her, we read 4 different chapters of the Bible, but the one that most impressed us was Psalm 35. He said, you've got to read it. Read it to your friends. Read it to your father. Her father was the pastor of their home church. So also a religious connection with the John Adams family. However, the reason Psalm 35 stuck out to them, this is where David wrote about Saul, that was King Saul, was persecuting him, and David cries out to God, says, God, I'm being chased for doing nothing wrong. The very idea that I am going to die when I haven't even done wickedness, Lord, raise up and deliver me from the oppressor. Deliver me from those who are seeking my destruction. Deliver me, and on and on and on it goes through this. Well, what's interesting about this is he tells her one of the responses they did after their hours of prayer and Bible study. He writes her and says, we have appointed a continental fast. So they called for a time of prayer and fasting for the entire continent. And here's what he told her he imagined. Millions would be upon their knees at once before their great creator, imploring his forgiveness and blessing, his smile on American councils and arms. So John Adams says, what I imagine is millions are going to be crying out and asking God for help. There were only like 3 million colonists. So if John Adams thought millions, he basically thought everybody's going to do this. Now, it's probably naive. I don't think everybody's doing this. Nonetheless, this is his impression. But I want to point out one of the very first activities of Congress wasn't just that they had prayer and Bible study. They called the nation to pray and fast. And if you look just during the American Revolution alone, the founding fathers in Congress had 15 different congressional calls to prayer, and there were two primary kinds. There was either a call for prayer and fasting or a call for prayer and thanksgiving. This is what you see, and this was a tradition actually started by the Pilgrims way back, but it's a tradition carried on in America that every spring you would do a prayer and fasting proclamation, because what the Pilgrims learned in the spring of 1623, that Squanto had taught them how to grow their crops and plant and do things. But in the spring of 1623, they got no rain. And with no rain, your crops don't grow. So Governor Bradford called for a colony-wide day of prayer and fasting that God would send the rain. And miraculously, and there's a really cool story, that rain came, this cloud hovered over their field for 24 hours. And for 24 hours, this gentle mist came on the Pilgrims' field. Like, it's a really, really cool story that's recorded in Bradford's journal among other Pilgrims. Nonetheless, that started a tradition in the New England colonies that every spring you would do a time of prayer and fasting, asking God for the year, right? For blessings and bounty and for rain. And then every fall, the tradition of the Pilgrims was we have a time of prayer and thanksgiving. So this was a tradition carried on by the founding fathers. And by 1815, what's worth noting is this prayer and fasting, these proclamations were so prolific, there was more than 1,400 in the New England colonies alone by 1815. By the governors, by presidents, by the Congress. When people today say, well, the founding fathers, they weren't really religious, or they didn't really believe in God, here's my favorite question. if they didn't believe in God, why did they pray all the time? Right? Like, genuinely, if you are an atheist, you would never do a prayer proclamation because there's no God. If you're an agnostic, you would never do a prayer proclamation because you're not sure if there's a God. Why are you going to call for time to pray to a God you're not sure exists? And if you're a deist, you're also not going to do this because deists don't believe that God gets involved in the world you're living in. It's a clockmaker theory that God wound it up and turned it loose and you're on your own. Like, none of this makes sense, except maybe the founding fathers are not the people that they're often painted to be today. And what's so cool about this, when John Adams wrote Abigail and says, we've just called for a time, a continental fast, this was the first prayer and fasting proclamation. And it's so fun that we can track historically through some of these writings and letters what happened. John Adams wrote Abigail another letter. And he said that Colonel Smith and his men have just captured a British fort. Now, generally, as an American, we have American pride. We have pride in our military. So to hear that Americans captured a British fort might not strike us as impressive as it actually was back then. Because when the war first started, we did not have a military, right? We had some militias, but militias were nothing more than rednecks getting together and saying, let's do this, right? Like, it wasn't an official military. And Colonel Smith, also worth noting, Colonel Smith was a farmer. He had been in the French and Indian War, so had some military experience, but he was a farmer who recruited the other farmers, who recruited people from the town, the shopkeeper, the blacksmith, right, school teacher. They get together, and they went up against the number one military force in the world, the British, and we took a fort from the number one military force in the world with this rabble of collection of individuals who got together. Also, this is a humorous thought to me, worth noting, Colonel Smith wasn't a colonel in the traditional sense, because back then in the early days of the militia, the way you became an officer and the rank of your position as an officer was based on how many people you could get to enlist under you to follow you. So if you could get a lot of people to enlist under you, you became a higher ranking officer. This was the first pyramid scheme in America, right? Sign up under me. And, like, this is crazy. This is actually how they became an officer, okay? Like, this is just bizarre. However, he goes on and says, not only have we just captured, Colonel Smith captured a fort, he says, we've just captured a 64-gun British man of warship and a 20-gun British man of warship. And we didn't have a navy at all because we were British citizens. We were English colonists, right? So the British Navy was our navy. So when this war starts, we did have shipping vessels in America, so we would just start taking cannons where we could and putting cannons on shipping vessels. If you ever go to Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian Museum of American History has one of the very first ever ships of the American Navy. It's called the Gunboat Philadelphia. It's up on the third floor. This is the Gunboat Philadelphia. John Adams tells Abigail, we have just captured a 64-gun British man of warship and a 20-gun British man of warship. How? Right? Like, did we row faster? Like, I this doesn't even make sense. Right? This is crazy. Well, what's so interesting about this is there were these moments where things were happening that made no sense at all. John Adams writes another letter to Abigail. And in this letter, he says, I was in a tavern tonight. And this is when the Continental Congress meeting. He said, I was in a tavern tonight. And I was just eating dinner, and I was listening, and there were men at the table behind me who were talking about some of the things that were happening and some of these victories. He said, and one of the men said something that I think is the best description for what's actually happening, for why we're actually having some success. He said, here's what that man said. He said, it appears to me the eternal Son of God is operating powerfully against the British nation. Right? I think Jesus is helping. Because there's no way that a rowboat is going to conquer a 64-gun British man of war. Like, there's no way. But this is what began to happen. And even we could talk about, like, even moments of defeat, it was still obvious God was helping even in defeat. Because, for example, after we do the Declaration of Independence, right, it's July 4th, 1776, it's presented before the American people. Well, in August, right, we're talking a month later, in August, this is where you have the Battle of Long Island. The Battle of Long Island, the Americans were vastly outnumbered. This is Washington with the American army, and there are 30,000 British troops against approximately 9,000 American troops. It was also known as the Battle of Brooklyn Heights, but the British have the Americans backed up against the water. So the Americans have nowhere to go, and the British, for whatever reason, because, right, they decided, well, the Americans are trapped. They can't go anywhere. So they ended up calling like a two-day recess. Like, let's just chill for 2 days because there's nowhere to go. We're not in a rush. We know they can't go anywhere. And so they sent word to the Navy, said, hey, why don't you guys sail up behind them so we can blockade them, right? We'll really trap them. And then at our leisure, we can dispose of them. Well, as word gets to the British Navy to come sail behind them, there's a massive storm that hits. And as a massive storm hits, it actually disrupts the Navy. The Navy can't sail up behind them anymore. And Washington realizes that seeing the Navy try to come in and they can't because the storm, because the waves and all the issues, Washington says, if they bottle us up, like, we are for sure done. So that night, Washington says, we have to get anything that will float and we have to get off the island. Well, what are we going to do? There's a storm. He said, no, just find what we can. We have to get off. Well, as they start collecting whatever rowboats and John boats, whatever they can find, the storm actually subsides. It calms, and then a wind began to blow at their back to blow across, okay? So Washington says, we have to get on these boats, start loading up. And so they start loading up on these boats. So all night, they're loading up. Well, there's 9,000 of them. There's only so many of these rowboats and John boats and whatever they can find. And so as they're going, there's still at least 1,000 men left as it's beginning to get a little light. And they see that dawn's coming, and if the British, at this point, they're going to be able to see that we're escaping, and they're going to, at that point, charge. And Washington said that he was going to be the last person off the island. He said, I'm not leaving any troops here. So then the men, right, his other officers are concerned for Washington. What are we going to do? What's very interesting is before the gray of light came in, there was a fog that settled over that area of the island. And the fog was so thick, Major Benjamin Talmadge, who was the head of what became known as the Culper Spy Ring, right, which that's what most people would probably know him for or from. Major Benjamin Talmadge wrote about this account and what happened. What he said was, a very dense fog began to rise, and it seemed to settle in a peculiar manner over both encampments. I recollect this peculiar, providential occurrence perfectly well, and so very dense was the atmosphere that I could scarcely discern a man at 6 yards distance. So a fog settles, right? You can't even see somebody at 6 yards away, so it's the perfect cover. So Washington says, quick, let's keep going, keep going, keep going. Washington is the last guy to get on one of these boats. He gets on the boat. When they get to the other side, the fog lifts. The British look and realize there's nobody there anymore. And the Americans live to fight another day. But here's what's significant. Even in defeat, the Americans recognize God was on our side. We can't control fog. Like, we couldn't bring in a storm to stop the British Navy, and then we couldn't bring a calm, and then wind at our backs. Like, there's nothing about this we could do. Well, this was in August, okay? Jump forward to December, right? At this point, in the American Army, right, all we've really had, largely speaking, are defeats, and many defeats, because we lost the Battle of Long Island, we lost the Battle of Kipps Bay, we lost the Battle of White Plains, we lost the Battle of Fort Washington, we lost the Battle of Fort Lee. We really lost all of New York, and because this is happening, there are one-year enlistments that are the norm for the Continental Army. And those enlistments are up at the end of the year. And so starting January, Washington realizes, we're not going to have any troops left. This is a problem. And of course, who wants to be on a losing team? I'm not signing up again. This is crazy. Washington knew they had to have a victory. So where are we going to go to find a victory? And also worth noting that morale was very low because they had not been getting any victories. And not only was morale low, they began to have massive desertions where guys were like, why am I here? This is crazy. I'm going back to my home, my farm, my family. I'm not doing this anymore. And in the midst of this, not only were desertions high, this is where the reenlistments, nobody was signing up. So Washington says, okay, what do we do? And the idea came that they could go up to Trenton because there was a fort at Trenton and it was Christmas time. And at Christmas time, looking at the idea of in Trenton, there were Hessians that were in charge of Trenton, 1,000 Hessians, and they were German. And Germans were known for liking their drink. And so they said, well, they really also, as a side note, Christmas was not really celebrated in America on lots of reasons, but because they believed that it cheapened what should be something sacred because it was, right, kind of this what we've seen a little bit today, right? Where there's a little more of a salesmanship approach. It's a little more about the money. We've lost a little bit out of Jesus. So they didn't really celebrate it very much, but they knew the Germans did. And they said, look, we can wait. And on Christmas night, we can go up to Trenton and we can go to the fort. And if we can take the fort, then maybe we can boost morale and they'll feel good about it. And maybe they'll sign up and we'll get reenlistments. And then we can continue to fight this battle. So this is what they do. So this is Washington, right, when it leads to the crossing of the Delaware. Washington has this plan where we're going to do a midnight crossing. And George Knox is one of the guys who's in charge of this. We're going to come back to him in a minute. Just important to know that he's there at this midnight crossing. So Washington was going to take, there were Washington and Knox were the two leaders, and they were each going to take several thousand men with them. But the way it unfolds, they were going to take 5,400 troops. They were going to load up their cannons and horses on these floats that were going to go across. But as they try to get across, this is December, right? You're up in the New England area, and there is ice all over the river, huge chunks of ice floating down, and there's actually a blizzard that begins to happen that night. And so conditions are so bad that they can't even get half the troops across. Only about 2,400 troops got across, so they're 3,000 short, and what they thought they could get across in maybe only an hour or two took them over 4 hours, so it's 4 a.m. They still had a 12-mile march, and there is a blizzard that's happening, and they were trying to be there before the first light of day so they can set up, and that way when the Hessians wake up, like, hey, surprise, we're here, and now Washington's realizing there's no way we're going to be able to make it before the light of day with this 12-mile march with all our men, and so we're going to lose the element of surprise. We have less than half the men we wanted. This could be a bigger challenge. Well, in the midst of this, this is where a blizzard now is breaking out. So if you are one of those soldiers, right, and especially you're a Christian, you're like, God, why? Right? Like, you have sent a blizzard. This is awful. Well, in the midst of them walking, one of the things we know is that the Americans, for so many of them, they did not have the resources they needed, including even the winter clothes they needed to navigate some of this. So in the midst of this march, there actually were two guys who actually froze to death during the march, okay? This is how bad the blizzard was, but because the blizzard was so bad, the Hessian guards at Trenton, they said, nobody's crazy enough to be out in this weather, so they called all of the guards in so they could stay warm by the fire. So there literally was nobody out scouting or guarding the fort when the Americans show up. And because there's nobody guarding the fort, they're able to get in position. By 8 o'clock, they're in position. And when the battle actually unfolds, right, when they fire, they kind of have made their announcement. It was a complete surprise. And in this complete surprise, they're able to defeat the Hessians, and they get a solid victory. And it only lasted 45 minutes, which was a very short battle back in that time. And so what you see as a result of what happened was on, and remember, the Hessians were fighting for the British. So on the British side, which really was Hessians, but on the British side, there were 20 killed, there were 100 wounded, and there were 1,000 that were captured. On the American side, there were 3 that were wounded. Done. Right? Now, nasty, awful conditions to get there, but also, interestingly enough, only 3 were wounded. Right? That's great. Well, one of the people wounded should have died, but that night when they were marching to get to the fort, there were marching by a row of houses, and there was a dog that starts barking. And so a man, right, just hears a dog barking in the night, and so he gets his musket and comes out, what's going on, and sees all the troops marching. And he was a patriot, but he went out and said, hey, what are you guys doing? And they said, well, we're going to take Trenton. And he said, well, I'm a doctor, and it's very possible that if you're going to war, you might need help. Let me come as a doctor and help. Well, one of the guys that was wounded was actually shot right above the heart, and it actually nicked a major artery coming. And so he was, literally, the record says, he put his finger in to stop the bleeding. He was able to actually go and cauterize and do things, save this guy's life. Well, the guy's life he saved is a guy who, if you've seen the picture of the crossing of the Delaware, he's actually a guy who was actually in that picture, but he's a pretty noted American. He ended up becoming the 5th president of the United States. It was James Monroe, okay? He was one of the 3 guys who was wounded, but here's what's significant, okay? Back up. They get a total victory. George Knox, one of the guys who was there, excuse me, Henry Knox, General Henry Knox, one of the guys who was there, he explained what happened that day, and notice his explanation. He said, the hurry, fright, and confusion of the enemy was not unlike that which will be when the last trumpet will sound, right? That's an interesting thought. He continued in this letter, he said, Providence seemed to have smiled upon every part of this enterprise. Everything that was happening, every American knew, God is helping us. Like, even when we thought this blizzard was awful, the blizzard had all the guards go inside. So we arrived late, but nobody saw us because all the guards were inside. Like, even in this crazy thing, God is still helping us. So much so that in 1778, George Washington, it was actually the 20th of August, 1778, he writes to General Thomas Nelson, Jr. Thomas Nelson, Jr. was a signer of the Declaration, who after he signed, he goes and he becomes part of the militia, then he becomes part of the Continental Army, he becomes a general in the Continental Army. And Washington was friends with him. They were both from Virginia. And he wrote to him, and he said, it's amazing, in the middle of battle, the things that we are seeing. Here's part of the letter he wrote to him. He said, the hand of Providence has been so conspicuous in all this that he must be worse than an infidel that lacks faith and more than wicked that has not gratitude enough to acknowledge his obligations. If you can't see that God's been helping us, you have to be just like either wicked, right? Like you're terrible at faith, something, because it's obvious God's helping us. Now, notice that that's one sentence. Let me continue on with what he says. He says, but it will be time enough for me to turn preacher when my present appointment ceases, and therefore I shall add no more of the doctrine of providence. Hold up. Washington's like, look, I'm not trying to preach right now. The time will come, maybe at the end of the revolution, when I do become a preacher. So for now, I don't really want to get into the doctrine of providence, but it's very clear God's been helping us. Like, literally, everybody who was there recognized the hand of God, and I could go through dozens, if not hundreds of letters that highlight the same thing. In fact, George Washington, just during and about the American Revolution, he talked about God's help more than 250 times, just during the American Revolution. It was obvious to anybody who was there, to everybody who wrote about it. And if you go forward, right, the last major battle of the Revolution, 1781, this is the Battle of Yorktown. This is the one where James Armistead got information to Washington, were able to capture Cornwallis. One of the things that happens is when we're able to defeat the British, this is the last major battle. Well, if we've defeated the British, really what that means is that we've actually been able to finally officially separate from King George, because now we've defeated his army. We are independent. So with the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown, this really kind of makes America officially, we're a free nation. Now, the peace treaty had not yet been signed. We'll come to that in a minute. But what's very interesting and cool about this is one of the laws of America at the time is we were not allowed to print any religious material or any Bibles in America in the English language unless we had an Anglican printing license. Because at that time, England was Anglican, and actually this is where like the king did the King James Bible, right, 1611, that was King James. But in England, they wanted control of the religious market, they wanted control of Bibles, and so all Bibles were printed from England, and then they were sent to the colonies, and so that was where we got our Bibles from. Well, because of the war, we had not been able to import Bibles for years, and the official printer of Congress went to Congress and said, guys, we haven't had any opportunity to get Bibles. We have a Bible shortage. We've never been allowed to print our own Bibles, but if we're separate from the king, could we print our own Bible? This led to the very first printing of a Bible in the English language in America. It's known as the Bible of the Revolution. It's also known as the Aiken Bible. The reason is the guy who was the official printer of this first Bible was Robert Aiken. Robert Aiken was a printer to Congress, but here's what's also fascinating about it. In the front of this Bible, it actually has a report from the chair. One of the things that Congress, like often they do, when Robert Aiken said, hey, can we print a Bible? Congress said, well, let's assign a committee to talk about that. So they assigned the committee. The committee said, we think it's a great idea to have a Bible, but if we do a Bible, it needs to be a really good translation. So they asked two theologians to come oversee the translating of the Bible. Well, those two theologians really were pastors, but they were people very familiar with Greek and Hebrew, and even, right, the Greek Septuagint and the Latin Vulgate. So they were able to say, yes, this is a very good translation. And so in the front of this Bible, it actually had the report from the two pastors. It had the report from the committee verifying that it is a very good translation. But here's what's awesome. It actually has an endorsement from Congress. The United States and Congress assembled recommend this edition of the Bible to the inhabitants of the United States of America. Congress not only approved, they officially endorsed the very first Bible printed in the English language in America. We actually have two of the original printing of this Bible. There were 10,000 originally done. There's only a couple dozen left in known existence today. The majority of them belong either to the Smithsonian or the Library of Congress. There's only a couple in private hands, and we have two of them. It's a very, very impressive Bible. What's worth noting, though, for our conversation, when Robert Aiken went to Congress to make the appeal before the founding fathers that we need a Bible, one of the things he said is one of the reasons we needed more Bibles in America is because there was a shortage of Bibles in schools in America where every kid was largely learning to read from the Bible. They said, we need more Bibles in school. This is from the official records of Congress where he says this Bible could be, quote, a neat edition of the Holy Scriptures for the use of schools. This is actually the official record of Congress where he says that, and Congress said, that's a great idea. We should print a Bible so we have a Bible for the use in schools. The founding fathers approved, endorsed, and encouraged it to be used in schools. If you go to the end of the Revolution, when the Revolution was officially on paper over, is when the Peace Treaty of Paris was signed in 1783. These three gentlemen were the ones from America who signed it. On the left is John Jay, in the middle is John Adams. On the right is Benjamin Franklin. The document they signed, known as the Peace Treaty of Paris, it is still on display in Washington, D.C. today. It is at State Department up on the sixth floor called the John Quincy Adams State Drawing Room. And if you notice, you see at the top, on the left side, you see there's 10 articles. At the bottom, there's signatures. The top one with the ribbon is David Hartley. But then there's John Adams and Benjamin Franklin and John Jay. What is worth identifying in this, this is the document that ended the American Revolution. It brought peace between us and Great Britain. It established America as a free and independent nation. Now, look at the title of this document. In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. That is one of the weirdest names for a document ever. But it's pretty awesome that peace for America came in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. That is amazing. And when people talk about, oh no, America's not a Christian nation, the founding fathers weren't religious, nope, we're not, like, you have to know almost no history to say stuff that dumb, or you have to have a very biased impression of history. And this is why, again, I can go back to that letter from 1813 where John Adams explained the general principles upon which the fathers achieved independence were the principles of Christianity. Literally, they were the principles of Christianity. And here's where it's also worth noting. Where did the founding fathers learn all these principles of Christianity? There was a historian who also was a theologian and a priest. His name was Bishop Charles Galloway, and he wrote about the influence of pastors in early America, the pastors that influenced the founding fathers. One of the things he wrote about the pastors of that era, he said, mighty men they were, men of iron nerve and strong hand and unblanched cheek and a heart of flame. God needed not reed shaken by the wind, nor men clothed in soft raiment, but heroes of hardihood and lofty courage. And such were the sons of the mighty who responded to the divine call. That was his explanation of pastors. That when God needed a leader, pastors stepped up and they were the leaders that we needed. Well, oftentimes today, again, we can talk about where so often people, they look to George Washington, or if we talk about the people most responsible, or maybe it's a Jefferson, or maybe it's a John Hancock. There's some very important founding fathers we could talk about. It's just interesting that some of the most noted historians, they point out the biggest influences weren't the George Washington. It was the guys influencing George Washington that encouraged him to do what he did. And if you go back, right, we can point out when Paul Revere, right, makes his famous Midnight Ride. We talked about he was really writing to warn Hancock and to warn Adams the British were coming. This is actually the printing of that British order where they said that their business was to seize the quantity of military stores and the bodies of Mr. Hancock and Adams. Right? Like, dead or alive, you bring them back to us. Why? Well, at this point, they were both leaders in the Sons of Liberty. They were some of the most vocal voices. John Hancock was about to become the president of Congress. Sam Adams was the father of the American Revolution. These were very influential, very loud vocal voices. They said, if we can silence those guys, we might can end this thing. So, right, this is where we talked about Paul Revere. Where does he find these guys? It was at the home of the Reverend Jonas Clark. Jonas Clark was the pastor that when you were the shot heard around the world, the 73 men were from his church. But this is where, and we'll talk about this a little bit more the next session, because I'll get into some of these pastors a little bit more. If you look at the first four major battles, top right, the battle at Lexington Green, top left, battle at Concord Bridge, bottom left, you have the battle on the road back to Boston, bottom right, the battle of Bunker Hill. This is as the American Revolution unfolds. And I'm going to come back and talk about that the next session. But right now, as the American Revolution unfolds, this is 6 weeks. 6 weeks, we have all this skirmish, all this battle going on. And as word begins to spread throughout the colonies that the British have now declared war, that we are now at war with the British because of what's happening up in Massachusetts, what's happening in the Boston area, Americans begin to respond. And it's so fun to see who begins coming and sending aid and assistance. For example, you have the Reverend David Avery, who led 20 men from his church to go and show up and help Massachusetts. You had the Reverend Stephen Farrar from New Hampshire, who came with 97 men from his church. The Reverend Joseph Willard came with 2 full companies from his church. The Reverend John Steele came with 900 of the men from his church. That would be considered a mega church today, right? In early America, that's massive. Well, also, the Reverend John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg led 300 men from his church in Virginia. It's just so interesting to see. As the revolution unfolds, it wasn't just pastors who were promoting the ideas that led to the revolution. It was pastors leading men in the revolution as well. You have examples like the Reverend James Caldwell. The Reverend James Caldwell was one of the leaders of the forces from New Jersey. Now, in the midst of him being one of the leaders, it was actually one of the deacons from his church who was the general, and he served under the general, except every Sunday he would do church services where his general would come and sit under him, and there's actually some fun letters between them, like really awesome. But they wanted to promote him further. He said, no, I shouldn't be a general. He said, let me serve under somebody else. He said, but I definitely can be here. I can help. I can encourage the men. And so he is one of the leaders of the forces of New Jersey as they're forming their militia before it became the Continental Army, because this is at the very beginning of the Revolution. Well, one of the very cool things about him as a leader, there's several cool stories about his leadership, but one of the ones that's worth noting is there was one day they were having a battle, and the men began to run out of wadding. And back in that day, right, for a muzzleloader weapon, as you're pouring in your powder, you pour in the ball, your wadding is, when you pack it down with a ramrod, that's what keeps the bullet and the powder in place so that when you go to raise it or lower it, your ball's not rolling out the end, right? Your powder's not spreading, so it keeps it compact. So when you fire, it's actually going to shoot at the end. Well, without wadding, you can't fight properly. And so they're running out of wadding, and he told the men, fall back to the church, fall back to the church. So they follow the church. He ran inside the church, and he came out with a stack of hymn books. As he came out with a stack of hymn books, they were Isaac Watts hymn books. Isaac Watts was the famous hymn writer of the day, and this led to a very famous phrase that was repeated quite often. But he came out with a stack of hymn books. He held up one of the Isaac Watts hymn books. He says, let's give them Watts, boys. Put Watts into them. And they literally took the hymn book, and they used it as they're fighting back. This was a pastor on the front lines, and there's actually dozens, if not hundreds, of pastors that we can talk about who were on the front lines. But one of my favorite stories of one of the pastors on the front lines was the Reverend John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg. John Peter Muhlenberg was a member of the state legislature of Virginia. Now, his father was the founder of the Lutheran Church in America. They had immigrated from Germany. His father started the Lutheran Church in America. He and his brother, John Peter and his brother, were both pastors. His brother was Frederick. Well, John Peter is part of the state assembly. At the same time, he's actually a pastor of 2 different churches. One was an English-speaking Episcopalian church, and one was a German-speaking Lutheran church. But as he's pastoring these churches, he's in January, he's in the state assembly, and this is where the American Revolution has already begun to unfold, because it was in April of 1775 that you had Lexington Green that shot heard around the world, and then the British are doing lots of things along the way. Well, in January of 1776, they came to Richmond, Virginia, and as they're assembling, the British come in, and they begin, just like they were going to do at Concord, they were going to go take all the military supplies. Well, military supplies was your guns and your gunpowder. So they came to disarm all the people. So when they came to disarm the people, at this point, Patrick Henry was the governor, and Congress was meeting, and they found out that there were 200 British soldiers going door-to-door through their town and through the surrounding area, taking away all of the guns, all of the gunpowder. And so Patrick Henry sends out riders, calls, says, you get everybody here now, rally everybody. And so they rallied nearly 5,000 men. Now, at this point, many of them are not armed, so they come, right, with sticks or an axe or a shovel or a pitchfork, and the British are armed and have a plethora of weapons and wagons, but they're single shot, and there's 200 of the British, and there's 5,000 of these Americans. So Patrick Henry got up, and he gave a speech about freedom and liberty and said, we can't let them disarm us and take our freedom and our liberty away. Go get our stuff back. And actually, as they go, one of the things that the officer ends up leading, and they stop the British on the road, they surround them, and the leader for the Americans said, that what you've done is not just disarmed us, take our liberty, you've stolen from us. And we are British citizens, the violation of the British Bill of Rights, et cetera, et cetera. He said, you have two options. He said, you can give us our stuff back right now, or you can offer to purchase if anybody wants to sell it at a price we agree to, but you're not going to steal from us. And the British officer, overwhelmed by the amount around them, said, I'm so sorry. You can have all your stuff back. Please don't hurt us, right? So they turned over all the gun supplies. But when they come back to town, Patrick Henry is meeting with the state assembly. And he says, guys, this is an act of war in Virginia, right? This isn't just a Massachusetts anymore. This is Virginia. This is an act of war in Virginia. He says, it's time to rally Virginians. We're forming our own military here in Virginia, our own militia, and we're getting involved in this fight. So this was in January when John Peter is there hearing Patrick Henry and says, hey, you need to go do this. And actually, Patrick Henry personally asked him to raise a regiment from his church. So John Peter decides he's going to ride back, and he rode back to his church. And as he rides back to his church in Woodstock, so he rode from Williamsburg, I said Richmond, it's Williamsburg. He rode from Williamsburg back to Woodstock, Virginia. And when he gets to Woodstock, Virginia, it was 197 miles as a crow flies, but it was probably 220, 230 miles based on how he would have had to ride his horse to get there. But he got there in time for Sunday church. And Sunday church, he got up in his pulpit, and he opens up his Bible, and he read from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, which says there's a time, a season, a purpose for everything under heaven, right? A time to be born, a time to die. Verse 8, it says there's a time for war and a time for peace. He closed his Bible, and he said, this is no longer a time for peace. This is now a time for war. He explained to them what had just happened in Williamsburg. He says, Patrick Henry has asked us to raise a regiment. He said, and we are now going to raise a regiment. We are going to war. He said, bow your heads, let's pray. Now, imagine you're sitting in church and you're hearing about this for the first time. And your pastor says, we're going to war. Everybody, like, get your guns, we're going. And so he bowed and everybody is closed eyes in prayer. And then he says, amen. And after he says, amen, they look up. And at this point, they were in elevated pulpits, right? There's no sound system in early America. It's elevated pulpits. So from his elevated pulpit, he began to take off his clerical robe. And under his clerical robe, he was wearing the uniform of a Continental Army officer in the Continental Army. And he came down from his elevated pulpit, and he began walking. It's one aisle down the church. He began walking down the aisle, and he said, brethren, we came to America. Our families, they came to America to practice their freedom, to have our religious liberty. He says, if we don't get involved and fight now, we will lose every one of the freedoms that we came here to enjoy. He says, I'm going to fight to preserve our freedom. Who wants to go with me? Well, 300 men end up meeting and signing up at the back of the church. They became the 8th Virginia Brigade at the end of the Revolution, the Battle of Yorktown. He's actually, John Peter Muhlenberg is one of the major generals who was there at the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown. Also, his men were there at Valley Forge where there's barracks that they had to erect in that very, very difficult winter. Well, as John Peter gets involved, his brother, Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, is also a pastor, but he's a pastor in New York. And he found out what his brother did. He said, you're totally wrong. He said, if you want to be a soldier, be a soldier. But don't think you can be a pastor and be a soldier. You need to pick one calling or the other because God doesn't want divided interests. So you, as a pastor, you shouldn't be involved in this stuff. Well, part of what he told his brother, he said, you would have acted for the best if you had kept out of this business from the beginning. I now give you my thoughts in brief. I think you were wrong. That's how he concludes his letter. Okay? Well, John Peter writes back. And he says that, do you imagine if it weren't for people like me fighting to defend your freedom that you would even have any freedom? He says, the reason you have freedom is because of guys like me. Well, he went on, he explained, I'm a clergyman, it's true, but I'm a member of society as well as the poorest layman, and my liberty is as dear to me as any man. Shall I then still? Heaven forbid it. I am convinced it is my duty to do so, and duty I owe to God and my country. Right? That you actually can do two things at once, right? We can make a difference here in the world we live in, and we can still be kingdoms of an eternal place, right? An eternal kingdom. Nonetheless, Frederick writes him back and says, you're still wrong. He says, the only reason you have problems in Virginia is because you have hotheads like Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry. He says, in New York, we are much more level-headed people. That's why we don't have problems with the British. Well, the truth was the British just had not made it to New York yet, but in 1777, they came to New York. And interestingly enough, the British actually blamed pastors for so much of what had gone wrong leading to the American Revolution that one of their common targets to destroy and burn down buildings was churches. When they would take a town, they would burn or destroy the church buildings, and there were 19 churches in New York City. They burned 10 of them to the ground, and then they went and they broke out the windows. They began to tear down the other nine. They destroyed all 19 churches. Well, he found out the British were coming. He found out they were going to target churches, so he told his wife and kids, get out of the city, but he stayed at the edge of the city, and he watched them destroy his church. At that moment, he had an epiphany. And he said, you know, I think my brother was right. Maybe I should get involved. And this is what happened for a lot of pastors. They decided to get involved. And this is where, right, if you look back, even when the founding fathers do the declaration, right, because now we're separating from Great Britain. Well, we were all British colonies. But once we separate from Great Britain, we now are American colonies. So we are no longer living under British charters. What does that mean? It means that every state had to write their own state constitutions now. So the founding fathers, after the declaration, the majority of them go back to their states and they begin helping write their state constitutions. But in the states, as they're writing this, right? So the founding fathers, they're meeting in their various states, writing their constitutions. It's worth noting who some of the major leaders were that were helping write the constitutions in these states. And in so many of the states, it actually was the pastors who were the ones meeting, helping come up with the ideas and draft and write the constitutions of those states. Even if you go forward, right, when we get to the federal constitution and the founding fathers that come together to do the federal constitution, after we do the constitution, which there's a lot of time I could spend getting into the constitution, but after the constitution is done, September 17, 1787, right, it's signed, and now it has to be sent to all the colonies to be ratified. Well, where are you going to send this to be ratified? Well, it's a government document, so you send it to government buildings, right? Well, only kind of right. Because in some states, they did not send it to government buildings to be ratified. In some states, they actually sent it to the churches to be ratified. Why? Because that's where all the political leaders were going to be on any given week. Not at their Capitol building. Literally, in many states, the ratification conventions happened in churches. And guess who were the delegates who ratified the Constitution? In many states, it was the pastors who were responsible for getting the necessary votes to even ratify the Constitution. When it comes to the Bill of Rights was done by the First Congress. In the First Congress, when they finally get the Bill of Rights done, right, there were 10 amendments that were signed. At the bottom of the Bill of Rights, there are only two signatures on the Bill of Rights at the bottom. One of them is John Adams, the Vice President. The second one is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, the Reverend Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, the guy whose church got burned to the ground in 1777, who had epiphany, should get involved. He did get involved, and he served in the state legislature. And then when we had an actual Congress, he not only was elected to Congress, he became the very first Speaker of the House. And when we even did the Bill of Rights, he wasn't the only pastor there, because his brother was a member of the first Congress, as were many other pastors. Literally, when you read the Bill of Rights, pastors actually helped draft, ratify everything regarding this nation in our government. See, if we look in general at America, one of the things that we have lost is the connection of pastors to America. J.T. Headley was a very famous historian in the 19th century. And one of the things he pointed out is the patriotic clergy of the Revolution were the soundest statesmen of the time. The pastors. They were the smartest, they were the best spoken. It's not to disparage any pastor denomination, I just want to point something out historically. Back in the day, just for one example, the Methodist Church, if you were going to be, well, I'll do all pastors first. So all pastors, if you were going to become a pastor to get a degree, kind of your doctorate from seminary, so to speak, you actually had to go to school longer than to become a medical doctor in America. Okay? This is kind of interesting. But here's what's super telling about it. So for the Methodist movement, for example, they required, if you're going to be a pastor in the Methodist Church, you are required to read at least 4 books a week. Because they wanted you to be able to address any question anybody had about any topic that might pertain to the Bible. So you had to know what everybody was talking about, what everybody was writing about, and you had to offer guidance, because sometimes, right, people are going to say and write crazy stuff, and you need to be able to say, hey, this new book came out, and it says this on this page, and that's wrong for these reasons. Pastors were literally the highest educated level of people, arguably anywhere, but especially in early America. But here's what's also easily confirmed. When we look at all America became, America never would have become America had it not been for the influence of the church and pastors. Like, this is not even historically that debatable. It was pastors who were the leaders and inspiration, and what we are missing so much in culture today is the leadership from the church and from pastors. Now, what I also can point out is this is just a little nuanced distinction. In the American Revolution, there were only about 25% of Americans that supported the cause of the revolution. And of the 25% that supported the cause of the revolution, there were only about 8 or 9 or 10% of Americans who actually engaged in it, right? Because some people were like, oh yeah, like, guys, I'm totally pro-life. I've never donated to anybody pro-life. I've never shown up at a cause or rally. But I'm totally pro-life. Like, it would be that kind of argument. Like, they're in the right position, generally, philosophically. They're not really engaged in the fight or the process, right? So there were people that believed the right thing. 25% were on the side of the patriots and liberty, but only 8 or 9 or 10% got involved. Well, if only 8 or 9 or 10% get involved, today we can look and go, America, man, I'm not sure if we can turn this thing around. I want to give you some of the most encouraging news ever. America defeated the most powerful military in the world with 8 or 9 or 10% of people engaging. If we look at America today, can we turn America around? I'm not sure that we're going to get 51% of the people to side and agree with us. But I'm pretty sure I can get 8 or 9 or 10% of the people to side and agree with us. And if that's all it takes to win the battle... It did not take every pastor in every church. It just took some of the pastors and some of the churches who had the courage, the backbone, the fire, the integrity to stand up and do it. Regardless, if it wasn't for the influence of the pastors, of churches, of Christians, it never would have happened. We're going to talk more in the next session about what can we do to get involved. How do we turn around? What can pastors do? We're going to give some specific thoughts and ideas. But I want to keep laying the foundation that this is where America came from, where we have derailed is we've abandoned that philosophy, the foundation that made us strong in the first place.